The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 263, Mormons versus Non-Mormons, Peter Rock's novel, This is the Place, with Eric Jones, John Needham, Paul Swenson, Rachel Day, and Peter Rock.
Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. This is, let me find the number here. Session number 263, Mormons versus Non-Mormons, Peter Rock's novel, This is the Place. First of all, I've got a couple of the usual things here to go over. Let's see. Admission to this session is by ticket or pass only, so if you haven't taken care of that, please do so out in the atrium. I'd like to welcome everyone here. My name is Eric Jones. I'm the managing editor at Sunstone, and I'll be moderating the panel more or less. Rachel Day will also be somewhat moderating. We're going to begin with Peter Rock reading from This is the Place, and then each of the three panelists, besides Peter himself, will address the novel. Whatever time we have left over at the end, we'll open up for questions and answers, and hopefully there will be a little bit of time at the end. After Peter begins, we'll go in the order on the program here, which is John Needham. John Needham lives in Logan. Let's see. Now, what bookstore is it that you are?
The Book Table.
The Book Table. Okay. You run The Book Table. He's a master's student in... I'm sorry, I'm not too prepared with this. American Studies at Utah State, correct? All right. Then we'll be followed by Paul Swenson, who is editor for the event. Those of you who are familiar with that know that it's a Salt Lake Independent weekly newspaper magazine, former literary critic with the Salt Lake Tribune. And then Rachel Day will follow Paul. Rachel graduated this year from the University of Utah in English and has been working for Sunstone this summer organizing this conference. So thanks to her.
I'm a mystery panelist also. Check your program.
The one with the three question
marks.
Okay, Peter.
All right. Hi, thanks everyone for coming. I didn't make up the title of this, Mormons versus Non-Mormons, but it's very contentious, and I just stick with it. I'm the non-Mormon. What I'm going to do is just read from the first three chapters of my novel. And I guess it was published in April, and I spent a couple months traveling around promoting it, and I think probably this is going to be the audience that understands it, some parts of it better than most places. I feel like I've spent a lot of time traveling around defending Mormonism against some unjust ideas. No one is satisfied where they are. Even the angels descend slowly through the clouds to put their feet on the ground. Swimming delights them. Their wings shed water, and splashing clumsily, they terrify fish. For angels, clumsiness is a welcome relief. Sometimes they lose their balance, but they must practice their stumbling, trick their grace. Yes, they drag their wings through the desert, across the salt flats. They gather along the border to watch what will happen. I am saying something like this, going off, and Anita sits next to me at the bar, slowly shaking her head. The others are only half listening. They look up when I pause to catch my breath. Behind them, the rows of slot machines blink and call. Nickels, quarters, dollar slots. A few desperate fools are playing, but the casino is mostly empty. The state line is always open, as it is easiest never to turn anything off, only to let it slow down. Out in the midst of the machines, a Cadillac sits inside velvet ropes and will probably only pretend to give it away. All shiny and pathetic on a platform, the car does not look out of place. If only we all stumbled with such joy, I say. Shut up, Anita says. The sameness of these nights is the best promise of change. I am patient. I have never known despair. If it's true I've been drinking, it's only because of the coffee. In the morning I must have a few shots if I'm ever to find sleep again. I'd like to sit, but I've been standing so long that my knees are not anxious to bend. Anita has a list of Mormon relatives as long as her left arm. She stretches out her arm and almost knocks over my drink. She says Mormon angels aren't like that, that they don't even have wings, that they look just like we do. Good night, I say. Past the machines, past the Cadillac, I work my way toward the door. Smoke has been collecting inside since the beginning of time. The voices keep on behind me, conversations that could go on forever, as if talking would keep people afloat somehow, prevent them from ever being alone. The door closes behind me, shutting out all the noise of the machines. The air is cool, it's 5 a.m, and lights reflect in the hoods of parked cars, colors surprised out of the darkness. The lights come from Wendover Will, the neon giant, 64 feet tall and made of metal. His gun is as big as a person, his cigarette a yard long. He is my brother. Waving and pointing at the casino, his smile is insincere, both ingratiating and contentious. You can hear him creak as he moves. With your eyes closed, you'd swear he was a windmill. A police car passes one way, then the other. Coyotes howl somewhere out in the desert. They are quiet when they come in close to town, so there's no reason to worry if you can hear them. Some call coyotes God's dogs, and that would explain how they became so quiet, so sneaky. Under Wendover Will, the sign reads, "This is the place," and he is facing east, making this claim across the salt flats, across the desert, over 100 miles to where Brigham Young is standing atop his monument, saying the same thing. This is the place. I know their argument well. In Utah, you will learn morality and restraint, and you will yearn for everything that you deny yourself. Here in Nevada, nothing is illegal. Everything is permitted and encouraged and will make you feel hollow. Believe me, the states need each other to recognize themselves, to savor the knowledge that there is an unhappiness more desperate than their own. Evil likes an audience, but good can't exist without one. Brigham is a statue. He stands in the confidence of stone, the patience of the truth. I felt the pull of the temple in Salt Lake City, but my pride is stronger. And in the parking lot of the state line, most of the license plates are from Utah. Neon demands your attention. Some people see all garishness as insecurity, and that's exactly why it's such an effective pose. Will shines on, waving and pointing. Stay close to me, brother. Come right in, we say. You're all more secure than we are. Your substance and not just bright surfaces. What could you have to fear? The dispute between Will and Brigham is not for me to settle, nor would I want it settled. The words hang over the salt flats, the most forsaken stretch of earth, a terrifying expanse of sheer space, white like another planet, hard and smooth where nothing can live. This all sounds so grim. I've known joy and I'll know it again. It's just that it takes work to get up the words to talk about love. I keep walking, turning away from Will, toward the lights of the other casinos. It feels good to shiver, and the nights are getting longer again, making it easier for me to fall asleep before sunrise. The slope down to the trailer park is full of ruts left by idiots with their four-wheel drives. All the alcohol in my body fights the caffeine. Down below, the boys' fire is almost out. A few are awake, the tips of their cigarettes glowing in the dawn, and the rest are asleep, sharing blankets. Pyro, the boys call after me. Hey, Pyro. There's hardly a house in Wendover. It's almost all trailers, as if putting down a foundation would be admitting something. My trailer is on the far side of the park, and as I walk through the others, I see the faint shadows of wings, the wooden butterflies a foot across or more, the people attached to the sides of their trailers. Some trailers have so many that it seems they'll be lifted right off the ground. Behind his window, my neighbor just raises his hand from the armrest of his chair as I go by. He doesn't even show me his palm. My dog's chain lies twisted and empty in the dirt by my trailer, still attached to the stake. I reach inside the front door and take out the flashlight. There's no one in my car, no one asleep in the back seat. I rake the beam of light under the trailer, bending down to see the broken bottles, the old snakeskins, then I step inside. The trailer shifts a little beneath my weight. I check the bathroom, the shower, even the small cupboards, every corner to make certain I am alone. Once the water runs hot, I soak my hands, bending my fingers, rubbing at the liver spots. If arthritis catches me now, it's all over. Most dealers have to retire because of their hands, if their eyes or their memories don't give out first. We'll see how much I can remember, how I can put it back together. After the water, I turn to my lotions. Yes, I'm not ashamed to admit I have more lotions than any woman, that I wear gloves to bed to spare my sheets. I squint in the light over the mirror. I am an old man, a ragged culmination, and that's an interesting thing to be. I turn out the light. As I lie in bed, I think of all the people I must tell about. I'll pray them before you all tricked out. And I wonder if in heaven everyone's motivation is true, if everything turns out well just as expected. Sometimes to find sleep, it is enough to admit that you've done and thought beautiful, terrible things. The second chapter accounts how the dealer meets a young Mormon girl named Charlotte. And I'm going to skip straight to the third chapter and read a little bit about what she's doing out in Wendover. The winds found no friction on the salt flats. They came through the sparse sage, climbed the sides of the mountains, lifted Charlotte's hair straight up out of her face. She sat still and cross-legged with the clipboard on her lap, leaning against a rock, her face turned upward. She looked fiercely into the sky, not so much taking it in as sending her vision outward to overpower all birds of prey. The jacket she wore was the same color as the mountain around her. She was invisible. She could go hours without moving at all. Some people fell asleep while watching, but Charlotte was never in danger of that. She was prepared to see scrolls unrolling in the clouds, see the whole firmament torn away. Yet she did not miss the hawk miles above. She picked up her binoculars to bring it closer. The raptors moved somewhere between perfection and falsehood, so rigid at times like kites they seemed fake and temporary, while often so fluid they seemed unreal, not bound to the earth. She had learned to appreciate this tension, and she suspected it was tied to the sadness she felt when she watched the birds, a sadness that came without warning, but not without pleasure. No one from her life before could find her or knew what she was doing. They had never understood her. Every hour she took down the weather, the wind's direction and speed. She marked the species, age, and sex of the birds that passed overhead, everything she could determine. Their power and freedom impressed her, but more than anything, she liked to watch the nets come down and trap it all. She had no pity for the terrified pigeons used as lures. The hawks circled above tighter and tighter, confident, and when they were set free again, untangled from the nets, they would carry a metal band around their leg. They would be forced to carry a part of the earth. Sweeping the binoculars out of the sky, she looked over the unbelievable white of the salt flats and beyond them, lights reflecting off the waters of the Great Salt Lake. Past it somewhere was Salt Lake City, and even Bountiful. She had not been unhappy there, though she feared her happiness ran shallow, was of a kind that came too easily. She was anxious to be tested. She was not satisfied. She had been shown the way to her satisfaction and could not accept it. Now she sat on the mountaintop watching for signs, hoping to be brought into contact with untold powers. She had not expected the other people, and she resented their presence, their claims on her attention. Long-haired men with gentle voices, women who didn't shave their underarms. They liked to stand watch together, motionless and transfixed, silent for hours, binoculars glued to their eyes. They spoke as if their religion was watching birds fly over the earth, and when they held hawks to be photographed, they smiled proudly, as if they had built the feathers, attached the bones, sharpened the beak and talons. The camp was down off the peak, and the trees out of the wind and slowing the sunrise. There was still snow in the shadows. Nights they passed a joint in circles around the campfire, and she just let it go by as she tried to get along with them. After a day of silence, they could not stop talking. They talked about how good it felt to be doing this job, how fulfilling, and she sat in silence. There's nothing quite like people who believe they're making a difference. Charlotte just looked across the fire at the cage of pigeons, oblivious, happy as could be, no concerns for the future. A girl played the guitar, unfamiliar songs. Someone told a joke about the difference between Jews, Catholics, and Mormons. Jews don't recognize Jesus, Catholics don't recognize Hanukkah, and Mormons don't recognize each other in the liquor store. They all laughed. Am I the only Mormon here? Charlotte said, and a quiet descended. It made them nervous to have her among them, as if she cared to judge, and eventually they compensated by acting out even worse than if she hadn't been there at all. They searched for a bottle of whiskey, cursed and wrestled, recalled tawdry stories from their past, and admitted to fabricated sins. They looked sideways for her reaction, hoping to shock her. They would not admit it, but they were afraid of her, so different and so proud. She prayed in her tent, listening to them down at the fire. She slept alone while the sleeping arrangements of the others were in constant adjustment. Her dreams were of hawks and eagles, her prayers full of questions. At first, I wondered if she hoped things with the world were getting better or worse. After all, for a Mormon, there's nothing so fortunate, no blessing quite like an apocalypse. They are the Latter-day Saints because after the apocalypse, they'll be left behind to have their fun. Yet this was not how Charlotte was thinking. It took me time to realize that all she wanted was the assurance that things were not staying the same, that they were changing. This she had learned from watching the hawks. All desire from change arises from loneliness, and this she was still learning. She had realized she could be alone while surrounded by others. Some never learn, figure this out. Some find ways to help themselves forget. When you're truly lonely, you're able to hear yourself. You're finally able to listen. Once she held a bald eagle, its wingspan wider than she was tall, unwieldy but strangely light, almost weightless. Its feathers had been cleaned by the sky, its hooked beak made to crack bones. Its eyes would not settle, they wanted to fight. We are never so fierce as when we're frightened, never so frightened as when we're alone. Sometimes when you first meet someone, you realize how long you've been missing them. Perhaps you have found another person you want to touch, who won't walk away when you lean against them, and who feels the same way, who will lean back so you both remain standing, so you don't fall and you are not left to writhe on the ground. To break a true loneliness, any person will not do. The wrong person will lead you through hope and on into despair. If she had a strong enough telescope, perhaps she could see her parents in Bountiful. She didn't need to see them to know what they were doing, but it was the same as ever and not that interesting. She was their only child, and they had to let her go. They'd be surprised to see her here, to see her joy at the snares and the nets, watching all that power trick down to earth. Coming in, someone would shout, the silhouette expanding above. The pigeon was nervous and didn't know why, standing on one leg and then the other, eyes spinning and filming over, the neck never still. A line stretched out to hidden hands. All were silent. Like nothing had ever happened, like nothing could be prepared, the hawk appeared only as it collided into the pigeon. Feathers were everywhere, both birds rolling sideways. The hawk righted itself with a flap of wings and stood atop the pigeon, turning to dare anything that walked the earth. The silent hands swept across and the net slapped down. Soon they'd have the raptor in a metal can with both ends cut off, its head out one end, its talons out the other, its wings encircled. They would carry it upside down, its beak pointed at the ground. All this she watched, she was only a girl. And below, miles away, my dreams of her were growing so violent that I threw myself out of bed and landed on the floor of my trailer, shifting the whole thing, waking my dog in the middle of the night.
As Eric indicated, my name is John Needham, and I am a student at Utah State University in the American Studies graduate program. I am now moving toward my thesis, and I've focused my coursework while at USU in this graduate program on Mormon subjects. I've looked in all the courses I've taken, history, folklore, and literature, at the struggle of the individual in the institutional church, that is, the institutional Mormon church. And I'm learning, as I speak to other graduate students like myself who are at other universities, that I'm committing something of academic suicide by focusing all my work on Mormons. But I'm enjoying the risk, and I'm going to, as I said, begin my thesis this fall, where I'll look at Levi Peterson's work and possibly that of Phyllis Barber, Brian Evanson, and Judith Friedman, specifically analyzing the place of the Mormon rider as a site of cultural resistance in Mormon culture. So then I wonder why I'm here on this panel, why I volunteered to be on the panel, to look at the work of a writer who is not Mormon, and though he grew up in Utah, is not necessarily of Mormon culture. I have actually better things to be doing. I have two incomplete papers that I should be writing right now. One on Zane Grey's Rise of Purple Sage and the films that have been made of that book and others. But I'm here because I think I have some things to say about his novel that will inform our understanding as Mormons of Mormon, of literature about Mormons or that treat Mormon characters. And also, perhaps I have some insights that Peter can gain from my comments as a bookseller. As Eric explained, I work at a bookstore in Logan known as the Book Table. I'm, as I've been reading Peter Rock's novel and other writings about him or by him, I've become a fan. I really admire him as much in character as a writer. I think he's a gentleman, as I have caught things here and there. For example, he was interviewed by Lee Austin of Utah Public Radio, and this interview was very cordial and nice. And being a good writer, I suppose, who knows how to make contacts, Peter sent him a thank you note. And that's just something that you would expect, of course, from polite people, but it surprised me because in the work that I do at this bookstore, I'm involved in hosting events with writers, and we've invited and welcomed some 30 or 40 writers every year, and it's not common that we get a thank you note for all of our efforts. In fact, Peter read at the book table to an enormous audience of four or five individuals. There, I think I gained the most respect for him and his dignity as a writer. He stood before the four or five of us and read with vigor and with decorum, even. And he persuaded me. I had not read his book at that point, but I was persuaded. But he also disappointed me, because when he first stood up, clean-cut and attractive as he is, I thought he's got to be a good Mormon writer, and this is going to be our new voice in the community, like Brady Udall. Then when he explained that he wasn't Mormon, but he'd grown up in Salt Lake, I was somewhat disappointed. But I think he does make an enormous contribution to our literature as Mormons with This Is the Place, and I trust his next collection of stories that's forthcoming will do the same, and his work in the future will probably always have some type of Mormon influence. When I look at this book, This Is the Place, as a bookseller, as a reader, as a critic in training, I have a number of thoughts. First of all, it's not typical that a book is published in paperback, or as it's known by its publisher, a paperback original, before it is published in hardcover. This is a calculated business decision made by Anchor Books, a division of Doubleday, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dale, to give this writer an opportunity to reach an audience that will pay $12 for a book and not $24. And I learned by speaking to his editor last week, her name is Tina Pullman, she's with Anchor Books, that they plan to publish his next book, which is, I guess, a collection of stories, I'm not sure how Peter would describe it, in a paperback original. Once again, attempting to reach even more readers, probably of the 20-something generation, as we can conclude from the design of the book, who will then, later, when they have real jobs, maybe pay for a hardcover. Again, this is a calculated business decision, but it's a wise one, I would say, because it is now in its third printing and will likely continue to be read and shared thanks to a few positive reviews, including one in Details Magazine, something that most young writers, well, writers in general, would not necessarily consider important, but it probably is working in Peter's favor to have had that review. As I look at the cover, I see other interesting features. I'm going to do kind of semiotics here of book jackets. You'll notice a photograph on the back, which is credited to Peter Rock. I guess he took this in his home city of Salt Lake, with seagulls obviously a Mormon message there, or a message that Mormons would interpret differently than most readers, if they would gather it at all. Some will notice that the truck that's installing this Whatever Will sign here is a Young Electric Sign Company truck. We, of course, know that to be a Mormon company, which is installing this edifice of Gentile strength. So there's a lot of interesting elements just to the cover. Those who know how books are published in Europe will recognize this to be a very European book in appearance, with the flaps that are, I think, very useful, and the rough-edged paper, and the paperback originals, in fact, how most literary fiction is published in Europe. Most of all, though, I think I like the stark whiteness of the cover. It stands out among other books. Again, I keep giving you the thoughts of a bookseller, but it's a well-done piece of work, and I think it reflects some of the thinking of its writer and its editor, whom I spoke to last week for some time. Something I like about the interior design of the book, that I promise this actually has bearing on the meaning of the book, is the way that the pages are, the text is rendered on the page. And I'm going to read from one of these opening paragraphs of each chapter that appears as so, if you can see it. The three of them moved as if they were on the moon. So slowly they seemed to be floating through a dream. One woman came out the bottom of the wooden box and went sideways like a crab along the floor. She was barefoot, and so was the other woman, who stood yawning, one hip cocked up and the other looking away. From time to time she skipped a few feet forward with one arm up in the air, sweeping the other as if she were displaying something, asking for approval. It had taken Keith a moment to understand what was happening. He had seen the act before, upstairs on the stage in the casino, but then the magician was in a tuxedo and the women were in sequined vests and tights. Now the magician wasn't even wearing his toupee. He smoked cigarette after cigarette, moving so slowly in sandals, shorts, and a sweatshirt. I'm told that it's suicide to comment on a novel or piece of literature in front of the writer, and it's probably even more deathly to actually read from the work in front of them. He obviously does a lot better job than me. What I tried to capture here, what I think he did in reading the very first chapter, was that this first paragraph is a brilliant piece of writing, followed by a good piece of writing as well, but a change in content. In fact, I think each chapter reads this way. You have this sense of floating into each chapter. The story is kind of in the heavens, and then suddenly, boom, you're in the stark realities of this very dark novel. And I think this should be credited both to the writer who created chapters that begin this way, that are very mesmerizing, but then also the person who designed the text to work into, to create the contrast that I described. So enough about the book from a commercial perspective and from that of a piece of art. I'd like to look at it now as from the perspective of a Mormon. There was last year, I believe, an article published in Dialogue that I think is very important, that has received attention, but maybe not enough, by Michael Austin, entitled "The Function of Mormon Literary Criticism at the Present Time." In this article, he posits the idea of the Mormo-American, and that literary critics, or readers of Mormon literature in general who are Mormon, should take very seriously the types of literature they read and whether that literature is accepted in the larger marketplace or academia or in American culture in general. Let's see if I can read some of his statements. First, he summarizes the direction of Mormon literary criticism that it has taken over the last 10 or 15 years, and then he jumps into his argument. Let's see. He explains that embedded in the assertion that there is such a thing as Mormon literature is the claim that we as Mormons, and particularly as American Mormons, represent a cultural entity whose traditions, heritage, and experience deserve to be considered a vital part of the American mosaic. We are claiming not just that we are Mormons, but that we are Mormo-Americans, that Mormo-American literature should be considered an important part of American literary studies, and that anyone who doesn't think we deserve our own place in the canon is a Mormophobe, whose position should not be taken seriously by an academy that values tolerance, difference, and diversity. He then explains how he thinks that the Mormo-American literary criticism should function both among Mormons and in the academy, and what types of Mormon literary critics are qualified to perform it. He then categorizes works that he believes should be considered by Mormon literary critics, taking the definitions, I believe, further than some of the past generation or current generation of Mormon literary critics. He suggests, for example, that we should be looking at books by Mormons written to primarily Mormon audiences, which obviously we do already, but then also books by Mormons written to non-Mormon audiences about Mormons. A third category, books by Mormons written to non-Mormon audiences, not about Mormons. A fourth category that I believe Peter Rock falls in, books by mainstream non-Mormon authors about Mormons. He explains, for example, about writers like Peter Rock and others who write about Mormons in their fiction. The popular perceptions of Mormonism have shifted almost 180 degrees in the past 100 years. Whereas Mormons were once used to represent lawlessness, chaos, and sexual promiscuity, we have now become standard stock for writers from Tom Clancy to Tony Kushner who want to portray a character as hyper-obedient, patriotic, conservative, and in all probability, sexually repressed. In the 90s, the typical Mormon character has become a Victorian misfit in a promiscuous society. This is very much the case with Charlotte in This Is the Place, I would suggest. In both cases, Mormons represent something other than the norm, a peculiar people whose inclusion in a literary text usually indicates the desire of an author to establish a foil for the values supported in the text. Likewise, Charlotte. Whether pro-Mormon, anti-Mormon, or somewhere in between, important non-Mormon writers who write about Mormonism give us a tremendous opportunity to make our faith part of our scholarship. In other words, he believes that Mormon literary critics, taking Peter Rock seriously and looking at his work with great care, will enable Mormon literature to enter the academy, to become part of the national literature that we know so well and find in our bookstores. So what would a Mormon reading of This Is the Place be like if someone were to do one? Here are some thoughts. I would ask the question of the book if I were looking at it as a Mormon literary critic. Do Mormons trust feeling over reason when faced with uncertainty? That seems to be the way that Mormons are portrayed in This Is the Place. For example, when the bishop leans close to Charlotte and asks about the signs she claims to have received, he says, "What else did they ask you to do? Did you want to do these things? How did it make you feel?" That felt strange to read that for me as a Mormon, but then I thought, I guess that does ring true. Another incident it reads, "I don't know," the sister missionary says when asked if she thinks the narrator is one of three Nephites. This is where she encounters the narrator. "But I think I could tell if you were, maybe. I could feel it." And then, of course, there's Charlotte and Keith who travel throughout Nevada and back into Utah, driven by Charlotte's sense that something's awaiting her, this feeling that she has. So in the novel, then, Mormons are presented as people who are perhaps less empirical and more emotive in their epistemology. And I think that maybe a fair portrayal, that if we had to go off or just work from what the narrator who reads the Book of Mormon in the novel in order to understand Charlotte, whom he's pursuing, he would have read this passage in 1 Nephi 17, for example. "Wherefore the Lord commanded my father that he should depart into the wilderness, and the Jews also sought to take away his life. Yea, and ye also have sought to take away his life. Wherefore ye are murderers in your hearts, and ye are like unto them. Ye are swift to do iniquity, but slow to remember the Lord your God. Ye have seen an angel." This is, of course, Nephi speaking to Laman and Lemuel. "And he spake unto you, yea, ye have heard his voice from time to time, and he hath spoken unto you in a still small voice, but ye were past feeling, that ye could not feel his words. Wherefore he hath spoken unto you like unto the voice of thunder, which did cause the earth to shake as if it were to divide asunder." So here in the first book of Mormon scripture, the Book of Mormon, we find very stark reference to feeling as a way of knowing, as a way of recognizing a divine sign. So maybe Peter got it right, I would have to say, as a, again, as a Mormon literary critic looking at the novel. And I then have to think about the Mormon missionary discussion, or the LDS missionary discussions that we who have served missions know so well, and the questions that we raise that Peter probably heard when he, as I understand it, spoke to missionaries in writing the book, very likely received the discussions and was asked questions like those that we know so well. Mr. Brown, how did you feel as we recounted Joseph Smith's first vision? Mrs. Brown, how do you feel inside as you keep the word of wisdom? Again, these are questions that we must ask ourselves as we read a book like this that presents Mormons in a certain way, a way that at first kind of pushed me back. I thought, no, this isn't exactly right, but then as I considered it, I found it to be the case. Another question we could ask of this is a place, what are we to understand by the portrayal of Charlotte as a seeker of signs? At first I found her seeking signs in the sand in the desert somewhat comical, but then as it continued and they multiplied, it became somewhat exaggerated, for me anyway, and I thought, now, is this really a Mormon? And I became somewhat defensive of what he was portraying. But then I began to think about my own experience in the day-to-day world of living Mormon faith and how I have sought signs on my own. I thought of how in the mission field, when missionaries spoke of praying for angels and seeing signs and so forth, I was frightened by that, and I prayed not to see an angel because I didn't want to. But yet, by offering such a prayer, I was essentially operating on the same level as Charlotte, as she does in this novel. Just last night, for example, this was a perplexing incident. I was staying with a family member in Bountiful, and in the middle of the night, a toy in this toy closet rang out at me, said something like, "A spaceship goes like this." And I sat there thinking, how does that relate to my talk? I mean, am I given this? Is this a sign for me to consider tomorrow as I give my presentation? Again, I, as a Mormon, think a lot like Charlotte, and I hate to confess it, but it's very true. A final consideration I'd like to bring to the novel derives from an article written by Scott Chisholm that was published in the centennial issue of the Utah Humanities Review last year, entitled "Centennial Blues, Reflections on Creativity and Literature in Utah." He describes that map that some of us know that pictures the writers of Utah, as he explains. Utah's apostles of the written word who make up the map include Edward Abbey, Fawn Brody, Juanita Brooks, Bernard DeVoto, Zane Grey, Dean Hughes, David Lee, Margaret Roskowski, Ivy Ruckman, Wallace Stegner, Mae Swenson, and Barbara Williams. He then proceeds in this article to explain how none of these writers, except for maybe one or two, can truly represent Utah, that is, the ethnic people of Utah, Mormons, whom we would expect to be producing a great literature. He describes them all as either carpetbaggers, transplants, walk-ons, or wannabes. This is rather harsh, I think, to say, but as he explains it, it's rather believable that these writers cannot necessarily represent the Mormon tradition thoroughly. So what do we make of a Peter Rock? Is he also a carpetbagger or a walk-on? I'm tempted to compare him to Wallace Stegner, a non-Mormon living among Mormons, writing sensitively and favorably about them, but also honestly. But then Wallace Stegner was not born in Utah and did not necessarily choose to stay, whereas Peter Rock was born in Salt Lake City and seems to be interested in writing about the culture. So I have to ask the final question as I'm asked to conclude. Perhaps the great Mormo-American novel of this decade will not be written by a Mormon, but a Peter Rock. Or speaking more hopefully, perhaps only novels such as Peter Rock's will inspire the Mormon writers out there to write the great Mormo-American novel. I certainly hope so. Thank you.
I was handed Peter Rock's novel last week for the first time by Rachel Day, and as a fill-in for a panelist who was originally going to be on this panel, I had to read fast, and I've been reading during sessions of Sunstone, and finished a few minutes before the session started. But the very first day I had the book, I was with a friend who picked it up and read the very first page with that intriguing block of type as each chapter starts and said, this language appeals to me. Can I borrow this book when I'm done? So that language is apparent on every page, and as a way of getting you into each scene, it is insinuating and very strong and very good. Strangely enough, the main female character, Charlotte, in the book, when I pictured her in my mind, I pictured Rachel, which gave it an interesting spin. I just met Rachel for the first time, but somehow they merged, and so as I read the book, I was pulled by that image, and also pulled by the obsession of the narrator with Charlotte, the character in the book, which kept me going along that narrative track. I must say that Charlotte, as she is set up in the book, she is the Mormon character, the main Mormon character, is very interesting to me, because she is in between the pull of this is the place in Utah and this is the place in Nevada, and you can feel that tension, the that is the Wendover, this is the place, the casinos, the darker side of the book, as it turns out, and the book is a dark book, and so that also kept me going. And as a hawk watcher, as a person who is set up as the reason she is where she is because she has this fascination with hawks and with birds, she becomes identified with those birds and with the freedom of those birds and with the experimentation of life. She wants to experience something different than she's been raised with, which is her Mormonism and her very normal sort of life. And so that pulls you through the book as well. I must say, however, that Charlotte, as the book goes on, I feel that rather than becoming what I wanted her to become, which was a symbol of freedom and experimentation, more and more she seems to me to become a character who is acted upon by other characters, acted upon by a character named Keith and his father, a character named Johnson, acted upon by the narrator, who is nameless, by the way, except for in the excerpt that Peter read, boys call him Pyro. So the arc of the book for me is a little disappointing. You can't say what you want to happen, but you want something to happen that keeps you in that arc, and perhaps because the arc goes from sky to earth, from light to dark, and becomes darker and darker. That's maybe my problem, that I wanted something more than that. I like the way that Peter's Mormon stuff slips in at oblique angles. The Mormon character, the Mormon references, are on the slant, but for me they work. They're little slices of stuff that, if you are Mormon or not, sort of interest you, sort of pique your curiosity. There's a place in the book where a character comments on the Mormon notion that in the kingdoms of God, the very lowest kingdom is a place that is happier than in this life. Don't hear that much from the pulpit anymore, but it's a uniquely Mormon sort of thing, and it has an impact. And those sorts of things all the way through the book, I like the way you catch those on the fly. I also like the way he slips in and out of the narrator's consciousness into the consciousness of other characters in the book very, very subtly. And sometimes you wonder whose mind you're in, and you have to sort of orient yourself and finally you realize you've shifted to a new perspective, and then you come back to the narrator's perspective. I think the book is very well written. I was interested in the characters. It's the kind of book that you wonder what happens after to the characters after the book closes, and yet I wanted more of Charlotte's experimentation and her freedom, instead of her becoming more and more worked upon by the other characters in the book and sort of slipping away and gradually being eroded, and then very dramatically and suddenly finding her exit. I'll say only this much, and I want to hear what Rachel has to say.
So, Paul's observation was one that I was hoping would go unsaid to anyone but myself about resembling the main character. But now that we all know, it's interesting. Let's see, briefly, I have a couple of comments, a paragraph I'd like to read if I can get through it. I'm terrible at reading in front of people, and then open the rest of the panel to some questions from the audience, because ultimately I have only one question for Peter, so I'll say that as an introduction. And follow was saying that for me this novel remains problematic, however much I enjoy it, and I'll start talking about that problem, which is ultimately a question, by reading this paragraph. Back outside, he waited for the police. Children were gathering still, laying their bikes down on the sidewalk, pointing to a spot of blood at the bottom of the stairs. At first, the flames were silent. They hid their smoke. They burned in straight lines and sped up to turn corners. They swerved in designs, stars and letters folding and closing on each other and themselves. Beautiful, scorching impurity like the Holy Spirit. Drafts ripped through the house, ungluing spiderwebs just before leaving them as cinders. Even the fire marshal could not explain it. He said there was no way the house could have gone up like that fast. And all this when the other side of the duplex was hardly burned at all. No one controls fires like that, the marshal said. I think that paragraph, for me, is reflective both of the mesmerizing character that John mentioned and the attention to language that Paul gave reference to. And for me, the book is caught and held by that central tension between an attention to the aesthetic of language, which I think that paragraph is representative of, and an obligation toward plot. In the previous session with Brady, we talked briefly about what an author's obligations are to an audience, to a publisher, to a distributor. And I think for me, I still come down on a traditionalist side of things, that one expects certain things from a novel, one of which is the arc of a plot and character development that Paul made reference to. And I found myself again and again getting caught in the depth and the richness of the language and the strangeness of the story. And really, it took me such a long time to read this book. I don't know how Paul managed to get through it in 4 days. I was working pretty closely with it for more than 2 weeks. And I guess I leave that as a question to the audience, for those of you who have read the book, but especially to Peter, how he feels about that tension in the novel, whether he was paying attention to plot as well as to language, or whether the plot felt obligatory, and to that end, you know, forced in some ways. One problem that I had with the book is that for all of one's investment in the world of the language and the world of the story, it comes to such a crashing halt, and I won't say more about the end, but I wonder if you could speak quickly to the issue of language versus plot, and then open the rest of the session up for questions from the audience.
I hope I understand the question well enough to answer it. I would say this is a strange kind of book, and when I wrote it, I'd written several novels before that, if it's a just world, I don't think they'll see the light of day. And part of the problem with them was that people said to me, the things you're writing about are very interesting, and you write very well, but you need a guide, you need someone to bring your audience into the story, because it's hard to get into it. Part of the reason I wrote from the perspective of this old man is I didn't want the guide to be confused with me personally. But I think I was saying yesterday that this book was easy to write because it is a book of obsession, and it was always clear to me what the concerns of the narrator would be in any given situation. If I imagined a scene, I knew what was important to him. I think there's a way in which the way he speaks and the rich language he uses does overwhelm the plot, in the sense that his character overwhelms his depiction of other characters. I think it's true when you write in the first person, the depth of the other characters always suffers because you're really unable to get into their heads or their feelings in a true way. I think in this book there's a lot of kind of false third-person writing where you wonder, how does he know this? He's not even there. And I think that's a valid question. At the same time, I think there are a lot of unexplained events in this book, and when I was writing it, I thought, maybe the narrator is setting this sign up, maybe Johnson is. How can I possibly set up a number of people in different ways? And eventually I realized that there were going to be things that were unexplained, and that was what was important, that the narrator did not have control over certain things. And I think the narrative is kind of his attempt to, and I would only pause to say I'm probably not the best person to explain the book to anyone. It's his attempt to explain what's happened and to absolve himself, not just to his audience, but mostly to himself. He feels as if what's happened, he had a part in it, but that his hands were guided in certain ways. So I would say that there is an insecurity or an anxiousness and anxiety on his part about what has happened, which makes it difficult for him to tell the plot in a straight way. He's explaining it, and he's avoiding some basic facts about Charlotte in the end. He romanticizes her throughout, in the same way that the tragedy at the book's close. I think there are ways in which, to be true to the way I started telling the story and to be true to this narrator, I did paint myself into a corner about the type of ways that I could fully explain the ending or fully round out some questions. I mean, I think the only parts of this book that I cut were parts that I realized weren't so important to the narrator. And I think there's a range of things he's able to talk about. On the other end, there are things that are so important to him he can't talk about them, mm-hmm. because he'll damn himself in some way. That's a long answer. I don't think I've ever spoken so long. Yes?
I was delighted with the book.
Thank you.
I'm glad somebody on one of our computers mentioned that they had seen a reference to the book. So I went out to the bookstore and bought the book.
And unlike some other people here, I found it, one, beautifully, relatively simply written, but very, very well written. It was not Baroque, as I tend to write. Somebody said they had difficulty with the plot. I didn't. I think it's very well plotted. The problem is, not a problem, is it tends to involve people that are very, very different and are, in effect, very opposite to what we know. I'm sorry, I can't remember any of the names other than Charlotte. Well, Keith was mentioned before. But mm-hmm. Every one of these characters is a strange character obsessed with something. Mm-hmm. The old man, the car dealer, is obsessed with Charlotte. Charlotte is obsessed with things. Keith is obsessed with things. They meet the young man,
Texas,
and he's obsessed with things. Mm-hmm. And the car dealer's girlfriend there, she's perhaps the least obsessed with things, but everybody's really strange in this book. And we get these characters coming together in such a way that it's hard really to plot everybody out. Mm-hmm. But I think that's part of the value of the book, is when we get through, I'm waiting to go home and read it again. Uh-huh. And if I'd had a little bit more time, I was thinking seriously, can I put together a paper for Sunstone on this book? Because I felt this was a book that would value a real close rereading and talking about, and trying to beat the bushes to get people to say, go buy this book and read it. Because wow. I think it's really a good book.
Well, thank you. I would only say that I just met my fiance's grandfather for the first time, and his first comment was, I've never met people like this in my life. And I think it kind of ties back to something Brady was saying in the last session, which is you want one way to bring tension to a story is to give all the characters a real desire for something or a real obsession. And I think in my anxiety about trying to bring enough tension to this story, I think maybe, you know, everyone does have an obsession in a way, and I think that it's a book about obsession, so that makes sense. I wouldn't say that it's representative of my writing, which is, I think other people who write books have the same sense. I'm proud of this book, but I wrote it, you know, 3 years ago, and I
place or
place
that's like it, because I can feel that having been there quality.
Well, you know. Does anyone have time?
We have time for maybe one quick question if anyone has anything else to add or ask. All right, well, thanks very much for coming. Okay, one quick...
Well, my question is, Howard, to you. I heard something that startled me. I know it was Paul who said it. He spoke of normal life, and then he contrasted Mormons somehow. My question is so muddled, it isn't a question yet. I'll drag my brother under the wire later and be more explicit.
Okay.
I'm sorry I bothered you all with it. Since I couldn't find it in my mind,
all right.
It has gone away.
Thanks, everyone, for coming this afternoon. Thanks, Pete.